Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson here, broadcasting from the Eastern Plains of Colorado. Son Daniel in studio with me today, and we broadcast to 80 countries around the world a message of faith, family, and freedom during a time when the family is coming apart at the seams. 41% of kids born without fathers, up from 6% in 1960. 70% of kids will not grow up with mother and father, at least in this country. We have the highest divorce rate in the world right here in the United States of America. Therefore, the foundations are destroyed. This nation may be the worst nation in the world as far as the condition of the family is concerned, but folks, we're doing something about it. Out here in the eastern plains of Colorado, we crisscross the nation, covering conferences all over, talking about the importance of restoring the family, doing some radical things, as in bringing back fatherhood and motherhood. I know this is weird. Establishing family economies in a fractured system we find today. And one of the questions that keeps coming back to me as I speak to homeschool audiences and audiences that are interested in renewing the family around the country is, why do homeschooling moms come home in order to prepare their daughters to leave home? Sounds a little ironic to me. Does it sound ironic to you? Well, folks, part of the reason why is because there are tremendous social pressures upon homeschool moms all the time. They want their homeschool daughters to turn out right and to survive to the next generation. One of the reasons why homeschooling moms return home to prepare their daughters to leave home is because 70% of young men are not grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970. I mean, this is a severe problem, an incredibly difficult problem. And, of course, that's tied into the fact that 64% of kids under 6 are latchkey. They don't have their mom. They don't have their dad for long, long hours during the time they're 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 14, 16 years of age. Okay, we've got some social pressures here, and it's a vicious cycle. So if you've got 70% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age, and 64% of kids under 6 are latchkey, which produces 70% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970, that will produce homeschool moms coming home to prepare the daughters to leave home, which will produce 85% of kids under 6 being latchkey in the year 2030, and 96% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age in the year 2020. Ladies and gentlemen, the problem is a vicious cycle. We got to get out of this somehow or another. Do you understand the tensions here? Well, the major problem is a lack of fathers and the fact that 70% of young men are not grown up by 30 years of age. That's the big issue we're struggling with right now in the year 2010. And we're going to address that next on a very important interview I am conducting with Bodhi Bakum, the author of a great new book called What He Must Be If He Wants to Marry My Daughter. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Kevin Swanson.
Children, it's time for your classics lesson. Let's pick up on page 214 in Plato's Republic, shall we? Our women guardians must strip for exercise. Then their character will be all the clothes they need. They must play their part in war. Wives shall be held in common by all, and children shall be held in common, and no parent should know his child, or child his parent.
Women nude in the gymnasium? Women fighting wars? Wives held in common? No mom and dad for their kids? Why is that, Dad? Why?
Are you tired of the pagan classics? Try the other classics. The Christian classics.
Back on the Generations Radio Broadcast, this is Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today, talking about a very serious issue, social problems that are throttling the family, destroying the family in the 21st century, but we are going to do something about it. We must do something different for our sons and daughters, and with me to talk about these issues is Bodhi Bakum, and he travels the nation talking about family issues from a biblical perspective. He's got a new book out called What He Must Be If He Wants to Marry My Daughter. Bodhi, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Thank you very much. It's always good to be on with you.
Bodhi, it was great to have you in Denver. You came down to our family conference, talked to 4,000 parents about family issues. You mentioned your book, and you talked a little bit about it. You have been wearing out the soles of your shoes, and you've been getting a lot of freaking flyer miles crisscrossing this nation talking about these things. What do we got? Family reformation going here?
You know, I really believe so. There is absolutely a reformation happening. You see it at the grassroots. But I think right now it's a painful part of the Reformation where people are beginning to wake up.
Yeah.
sometimes that's not pretty. And a lot of people, unfortunately, as they're waking up, they're sort of opening their eyes and asking two questions. Number one, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And number two, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
So it's good. There is a Reformation happening, but right now I believe it's at a very painful stage for most people.
Yes, yes. At a time when America has the largest divorce rate in the country, or in the world, 8 times worse than Spain, by the way. We're doing awful in just about every indication. According to Rutgers University, we have the worst families in the Western world. Okay, that's Rutgers University. Came out about 3-4 years ago. We're in trouble. It's time for families just to recognize these things and do something different. And I think your message is critical. Obviously, we're addressing a lot of the homeschooling movement. You're off to Ohio this week. I was just in Missouri this morning at 3:30 this morning before we broadcast this program. It's been a wild, wild year. How many conferences have you done so far?
I think 3 or 4.
Okay. Okay.
Not that many more left.
Yeah, yeah. Well, God bless you as you talk to those folks in Ohio. And let's talk a little bit about your book. You know, it's interesting. New York Times came out with an article last week. This is on my birthday, June 14th. Long Road to Adulthood is growing even longer. I guess the average marriage age now for the average young man is 28 years old. They're putting it off longer and longer into the 30s. I mean, I know a lot of Christian folks, evangelicals, that are doing the same thing. The fact of the matter is, their people aren't growing up. They're just not growing up. And I think that's the fundamental problem we're dealing with, especially with boys.
You know, it really is. And there are a number of reasons for that, not the least of which is we're absolutely spoiled. We've got young men who don't want to struggle. They don't want to suffer. They don't want to leave home until they can have the exact same kind of middle class, upper middle class life that their parents are providing for them.
Mm.
So you don't see young men with any willingness to sort of strike out and have to do it the hard way for a while and earn their way in the world, so to speak. It's not happening.
And what happens with the secular folks is that they're just going to party through their 20s. That's really what happens. I mean, they might have some dating going on, some shacking up, hooking up being the up-and-coming approach. That is, you just kind of hook up for, 2 weeks, and then you're done with that girl and you move on to the next. It's a party life for the secularists. But what's happening with the nice little homeschooled kids, the Christian evangelical kid that had a fairly decent raising? His folks, put him off into college or what have you, but he just wasn't growing up. In fact, I had a homeschool leader from North Carolina say he was concerned his son was going to one of the very best, I would say one of the very best Christian colleges in America. This leader was still concerned that his son was hanging out with immature people and, it just wasn't clicking. He didn't think his son was really maturing in college.
Well, it's interesting. My question would be, what on earth would you expect?
Yeah.
The college system is not designed to mature people. And again, the Proverbs makes it very clear, the companion of fools will suffer harm. And there are fools on Christian college campuses, just like there are fools on non-Christian college campuses. And those fools are not going to bring our children to maturity.
Yeah.
Beyond that, if you're waiting for that period of a child's life to start working towards maturity, you've waited too long.
Yeah.
We got to start working toward maturity long before that time frame even gets there.
Yeah. You know, Vody, I think what helped me was my dad said, yeah, you better go to college. But he said something else. He said, I'm not paying for it. I mean, to me, that's what really matured me, because I would take an average of 3 to 5 part-time jobs while I was going to college. I was working 30 hours a week and studying for 30, 40 hours a week. I was engaged in a lot of things. I graduated out of debt. I had some investments, and I was able to put a down payment on a house after my graduation thanks to my part-time work that I had done in college. In other words, work was, I think, the thing that really matured me. Sitting around in a college fraternity and having fun is not really the best way to mature a young man into life and get him ready to cut a piece out of the rock for himself. I think work is a key here.
You're absolutely right. And not only work, but I think marriage. As one man said, I can't even remember who it was, but I stole it, and I told him I was going to steal it.
Yeah.
Somebody asked him where he grew up. He said, well, I grew up mostly in Texas, or I grew up some in Texas, but mostly after I got married, you know? And I said, I'm absolutely stealing that, because it's true.
Yeah.
I grew up a lot more when I got married. I got married my sophomore year in college.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was married when I was a sophomore. I had a daughter when I was a junior, 10 months after I got married.
Yeah.
Of course, having to work, raise a family, and do all those things, my grades actually went up. People were afraid of the opposite, you know. But when I got married and had to work harder in order to take care of a family while I was still in college, my grades went up just because of the level of maturity with which I then approached that time in my life. And it was go to work. It was take care of your duties and responsibilities at home. It was, you know, all of those sorts of things. And that's where you grow up. But we have young men now. They'll go off to college. They don't have to have a job. We tell them they can't get married until after that period of their life is over. So the two main things that God uses to mature a man are removed from them while they're put in an environment where all of the world, the worst the world has to offer, is readily available to them 24 hours a day.
I don't know who came up with this brain scheme, but it was one of the worst probably in the history of the world. And by the way, the history of college is not really all that good. Remember, John Adams' son wound up getting drunk and running nude through Harvard back in the 1780s. So it hasn't been good since the 1780s. It's had a really bad record. And here's one of the real issues is there just aren't enough mentors in the lives of these young men. And this is really where the discussion went with this leader from North Carolina. I just said we've got to have more mentors out there. I mean, grown men who can teach young men how to be a grown man.
And, you know, that's not even part of the thinking process for most professors.
Yes.
That's not even on their radar screen. Mm. The other thing is, as colleges become so lucrative, you know, the more students you can get, the better. You know, the facilities have become just out of this world.
Yeah.
And so you gotta have that class chock full of, you know, 100, 150, some classes with 200 students in them. There are people in upper level courses with 50, 75 kids in them, in graduate courses with that many people in them at some of these, you know, large universities. There's no mentoring that's going to happen in that situation.
No. I had a college with 17,000 students. I had an advisor. Okay, I go to meet him the first week at college at my university. I went to meet him. I said, I'd like to come back and meet with you, like, you know, every other week, every month, something like that. He said, No. If I had things my way, I'd just as soon sit here and contemplate my navel. I kid you not, Bodie. That's what he said. That was about as relational as my professors became with me.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, this whole publisher perish mentality, you know, the professor who's basically in the ivory tower publishing books compared to the professor who is working hard to mentor students, one of those guys is going to advance. The other one is not. And I guarantee you the one who's advancing is not the one who's investing time mentoring students.
Yeah.
It's the one who's actually publishing and who's actually investing in that side. Again, not saying that it's not important to have researchers and writers and things of that nature, but the mentoring part of it is almost completely gone. Not to mention the fact that even in the home, you talk about the homeschool movement, one of the things that I'm seeing in the homeschool movement and beginning to speak to is these feminized boys in the homeschool movement whose fathers are absolutely uninvolved in their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
These boys are being raised, mentored, educated, and discipled almost completely by their mothers, and it shows.
It's the Achilles heel of the entire movement. As a leader in the movement over 12 years, I agree with you. This is the number one problem that exists within our homeschool movement. But let's get back to your book right now, What He Must Be If He Wants to Marry My Daughter. You know, what's interesting, as I read your book, you got a lot of peas in this book. I guess Bodie Buckham likes peas. You talk about protector, priest, you know, on and on. Well, let's talk about patriarchy. And that's where you really begin the book. Because I think that's a really key word. Not necessarily the most popular word today. Nobody likes patriarchs these days. And you start talking about patriarchs and suddenly you know, somebody starts blogging against you, you know, within about 2 hours, you know. But
you live in that world too, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah. but you talk about patriarchy. You say this is basic. This is something our young men have to understand.
Yeah, they do. And patriarchy, in its simplest form, is just the idea of male headship that has existed as a creation ordinance since God created Adam first.
Hmm.
It is an idea. Speaking of patriarchy, I just had one of my sons.
Keep on going, Vody. Keep on going. We do this all the time. We do this all the time.
Okay.
It's just more organic this way.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it is. It is the idea of male headship, male leadership in the context of the family, and even broader than that. So I start there because if we don't get that, if we don't understand the root and the foundation, then we completely miss the whole picture.
Yeah, yeah. What is it to be a patriarch in the home? Can you describe somebody who's ready to be a father, a husband, a head? He's ready to take charge. Tell us what that looks like.
Well, you know, that's where those other four P's come in. You know, okay. Priest, prophet, provider, protector.
Okay.
And I derive that from that quote, a great quote from George Whitefield, who says that every man ought to look upon himself as functioning. He says in three categories, a priest to pray for and with, a prophet to instruct, and a king to protect and provide for it, essentially. And so I look at that, you know, being a priest is one who represents his people before God. So here is a man who is an intercessor, a man who has a relationship with God, who is dependent upon God, who is a spiritual man and a spiritual leader. A prophet is one who represents God before the people.
Mm.
Here's a man who knows the word, can teach the word, and communicate the word. And we know he has that responsibility in Ephesians chapter 5 for his wife and in Ephesians chapter 6 for his children. Provider, mm. We know 1 Timothy 5:8, a man who doesn't provide for his family has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel.
Mm.
And then, of course, a protector. A man has a responsibility to place himself between his family and anyone or anything that would do them harm.
Yes.
So it's not until a man understands himself in those roles and has proven himself in those roles that he's ready to assume the role as the head of a household.
How can you tell he's proven himself? I mean, give me some examples. How do you know this guy's ready to be a priest and a prophet in his home?
Well, as far as priest and prophet, that's when you have discussions with him about doctrine and theology.
Yeah.
Does he know the word?
Okay.
Does he have, you know, not does he have everything figured out?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a 41-year-old elder in a church, and I'm growing and learning every day.
Join the club, yeah.
Yeah. So you're not looking for a guy who's got everything figured out, but you're looking for a guy who has a basic biblical worldview, a basic biblical construct. He knows the Bible. He knows his way around the Bible. He understands the Bible storyline. He knows what the gospel is. He can communicate that clearly. He knows how to analyze Scripture, interpret Scripture, and think biblically.
Yes.
Those are the kinds of things that you're looking for. And he understands that it is his duty to know these things.
Yeah.
So in that area, that's what you're looking for.
So if you were to ask this young man, is God sovereign? He would, first of all, be able to define what you mean by sovereignty, and secondly, he'd be able to go to the Word of God and find specific passages in relation to the nature of God and his sovereignty.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you should be able to do that. And the other thing is, even if you come across things, so let's say you're having a discussion with a young man, and you bring up some concepts that he hasn't mastered. And he can't go right through them.
Yeah.
Well, he ought to be able to say to you, you know what, I'm getting back to you on that tomorrow.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, and sure. have some tools and know how sure. to use them.
Mm-hmm.
Go search the thing out, know where to go and look and read. And I want to know what he's reading.
Yeah.
I want to know what books from a theological perspective he has on his shelf,
mm-hmm.
what books he's reading, what kind of things are influencing
mm-hmm.
him.
If he's still sitting around reading Dr. Seuss and the Hardy Boys, we're in trouble.
Yeah, we're absolutely in trouble. Yeah. The only thing worse than that is if he's reading Brian McLaren. But he needs to be reading the types of things that indicate that he's thinking seriously and that he's thinking biblically and that he's being challenged and he's maturing and growing in his faith.
All right, Protector, if a young man came to you and said, I'm really interested in marrying your daughter, and you want to figure out whether this guy's going to be a good protector for your daughter, how do you make that call?
Well, a couple of things. The first indicator is when and how he approaches me. Now, if a young man approaches me and says, your daughter and I, you know, this is the way it happens in our culture. Your daughter and I have been dating for a couple of years now, and I'm thinking about asking for her hand in marriage, and I want to talk to you first. That's a poacher, okay? That's not a protector. That's a poacher. The protector is the one who says, I'm interested in your daughter. She's not aware of that interest yet. And the reason she's not aware is because I did not want to jeopardize her heart. I didn't want to jeopardize her emotions. And I know that you're responsible for that. And I wanted to come to you first and foremost to declare my interest and to have you vet me so that, if possible, we can even avoid your daughter being hurt at all if I'm not a good match for her. See, that man is demonstrating to me that he's interested in protecting my daughter, that he's committed to protecting my daughter, even from himself, if necessary.
And you talk about a poacher, and we know poachers are out here in Colorado. I mean, these are guys that go ask for the tag after they shoot the animal.
See, here's the thing, and I talked about this at the Colorado conference. These kids, they not only come and ask for the tag after they shoot the animal, they ask the game warden to pay for the tag.
Oh, man. We've got to see some shifted worldviews, some shifted perspectives in a lot of families before we start seeing our daughters marrying well and our sons marrying well as well. This is the foundation of new families. If we want to rebuild families in the 21st century, it really begins right here, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, it has to. We have to. You know, we can't cry over spilled milk.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy for us to look back and see where our forefathers have gone wrong and where this happened and that happened. And those things are important. But they're important, again, in our therapeutic culture. We look back to figure out what went wrong so that we have an excuse for our dysfunction. We can't do that. We look back to see where our forefathers went wrong so that we can learn from their mistakes and operate in a different way. We don't look back so we can make excuses. We look back so we can make corrections.
Vody, let's talk about your own situation. I mean, you've got a beautiful young daughter yourself and more along coming along. Are you ever concerned that your expectations may be a little too high for a prospective suitor?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not concerned. Might they be too high? Yes, they might. But I love my daughter, and I'm not concerned about that. I'd be concerned if they were too low. If they're too high, we can make adjustments in that. But if they're too low, we've got a real problem. See, if my expectations are too high, the penultimate chapter in What He Must Be is the title of it is If You Can't Find One, Build One.
Yes, right.
And my argument there is, I don't expect for a young man in his 20s to come along and be just completely ready.
Yeah.
And as a father, at that point, it's not my responsibility to just say, no, son, I'm sorry, goodbye.
Yeah.
But I need to actually invest into the life of that young man.
Amen.
And disciple that young man and mentor that young man so that he can be brought along and best prepared.
It may be a good idea, Vody, for young men to come to some of the fathers, the elders in the church, men like you, before they even broach the subject of your daughter, and just say, you know, I would like a little of your counsel. I mean, you know, I'd like to sit down with you, and I'd like you to give me some pointers in life, and kind of get some mentorship up front before they even get involved in this courtship game.
Absolutely. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Because what we're going to have, and what I argue for in that chapter, is we have to have a culture of discipleship.
Yeah.
Because one of the dangers, of course, I had a man come up to me and say, you know, I tried that, But when I did it, you know, my daughter, she got a little too close emotionally, and this guy got a little too involved emotionally. I said, well, let me ask you a question. Did you have a pattern of discipling young men? He said, no.
Yeah.
I said, so, you have a daughter of marriageable age. You bring a young man of marriageable age along. You start discipling him, and she knows that you're doing this so that he can be prepared to be her future husband. And you wonder why
yeah.
the two of them got
yeah.
too emotionally involved.
Yeah.
His eyes got as big as saucers, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
if you have a culture of this where you're regularly investing in young men,
yeah.
You don't have as much tendency
yeah.
for that to happen.
Bodie, I've got four daughters, ages 9 to 15. And I will tell you that this year I started a shepherd center. 4 years ago I started mentorship. Now I've got a shepherd center. I've got seven or eight young men in my basement 3 days a week. I'm doing mentorship well ahead of the game because I have four daughters, Vody. Did I mention I had four daughters?
Amen.
We got to be mentoring. You know, I think elders, pastors, fathers across this country, by the hundreds of thousands, need to be doing what we're starting to do right now. I mean, we're not experts with this kind of thing, but we've got to create the pool. If we don't, we're going to be in trouble in the year 2012, 14, 18, 20.
Well, you know, I think it's the height of hypocrisy to scream from the rooftop, where are all the men? And not be doing anything at all to rectify the problem.
And you said it better than anybody's ever said on that program right there. I thank you for saying that right now. The book is What He Must Be If He Wants to Marry My Daughter. The author, Vody Baucom. Vody, thanks again for joining us on Generations.
Hey, it's an honor. Thank you. Thanks for the work that you do.
And folks, again, let me encourage you to grab a copy of What He Must Be by Vody Baucom, available at our website. It is a readable book. It is a interesting book. It brings up a lot of important issues for our sons and our daughters, of course. The book is What He Must Be If He Wants to Marry My Daughter by Vody Baucom, available at kevinswanson.com. Just click on store. And that's where you can hear this program anytime, anywhere in the world. That's kevinswanson.com. Get your friends and family members tuning into us at kevinswanson.com. Also available at the American Family Association's homeschoolchannel.tv. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.